Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, students, you may think you see here before you a free agent. Free agent who got back from Korea 10 days ago and can do and say what she pleases. But that's not so. I'm here under a very specific set of instructions, and they come from my colleagues, newspaper men in Tokyo. Just before I left Tokyo, they took me aside and gave me a lecture on how to behave when I got back to civilization. They reasoned that with almost 8 months at a war front, that I might not quite know how to accustom myself and adapt myself to life in America. For example, this is the highest concentration of ladies that I've seen in a long time. Anyway, they thought that having been surrounded by an army, which, as you know, is an organization composed generally exclusively of men, I might need a few pointers. And Carl Mydens of Time and Life took me aside and told me, and I'm quoting him, "Now, Maggie, when you get to America, if you hear anything bad, any four-letter words or anything, please remember to look sharp." Well, I haven't noticed any, and I don't know whether that's a bad or a good sign. I came here to talk to you about the war in Korea, which, as you've seen from the newspapers, is going very much better today. But I'm in the cautious department for a reason that going up and down those roads, first forward, then backward, then forward, then backward, I hesitate to come to any conclusions about victory. My feeling is that perhaps we will have local gains, but that we must wait for a little while before we can say that we have had anything decisive. A GI in Korea summed up my feelings pretty exactly one day after he'd retreated from Seoul and then approached again to the outskirts of Seoul by saying, "I've been up and down these roads so much I feel like a yo-yo." In talking about Korea, I'm going to talk first about the early days, because I think that a country, like an individual, frequently learns the most from his own mistakes. And the mistake and the sad part of those early days and the terrible part of the lost battalions and the soldiers who had to hold at any cost, when the cost they knew meant that they and their men would be captured or killed, was a very simple fact when you stated here on a platform. But it all comes down to being very, very unprepared. I have the very sad privilege of being something of an expert on retreats. My first retreat began 2 days after the Korean War started. I flew into Seoul on the last evacuation plane. We went into that city thinking that it had fallen, and our pilot had been told by the briefing officer, "Fly low, look at the field. If there are some Americans there, or if a green flare goes up, fly down and land. If there's no flare and you see nobody, get the hell out, because the field will be occupied by the enemy." When we landed, we saw the Americans there, and they were waving at us with all the frenzy of people who are shipwrecked and are afraid that the rescue ship will go by. When we landed, we were greeted in addition to those frenzied Americans, was a very calm colonel of a group called the Korean Military Advisory Group. And he told us that although everyone had left the city, it had not yet fallen into enemy hands, and that the K-Mag, as we nicknamed them, had just come back into the city in the hope that it might hold out at least for a few more hours. There were four correspondents. We elected to stay with the colonel, and the plane went off. Well, we went into the city where the K-Mag chief, Colonel Wright, briefed us about the situation. He called it, and this is a very deceptive term, fluid. It was fluid, all right. There were red tanks at the north gate of the city at that time. I remember a conversation in this headquarters, KMAG headquarters, in Seoul, night of June 27th, in the beginning of the war. In that conversation, Colonel Wright said with disgust in his voice, "The tanks, the Soviet red tanks, are what broke the back of the South Korean army. If they had used their weapons properly, they could have stopped, the South Koreans could have stopped those tanks." I think that Colonel Wright must have lived to bitterly regret his words. It's just an example of how much we underestimated the enemy. You all remember now, and time has shown, how fast and how far our own American troops ran in the face of those Soviet red tanks. And the reason they ran was because we had at that time what you call the 2.5 bazooka. And a GI using a 2.5 bazooka, unless he got up very close and had a very, very lucky shot, saw that his missiles just bounced off. We used to call it just tickling the Soviet red tanks, and they came on at him anyway. Many lives were lost, many battles were lost because we were unprepared, because we didn't have good anti-tank weapons at that time. We later got them with a 3.5, but that was after many people were dead unnecessarily. Even when we got our own light tanks in, they weren't enough, and they were inadequate to cope with the Soviet red tanks. I can tell you an incident that has stuck in my mind to show you how inadequate our light tanks were against the Soviet tanks. We'd all been waiting very, very eagerly to have some armor ourselves, and this was about the sixth or seventh day of the war, and a group of us, about three or four correspondents, were astonished in coming around a curve in a mountain road close to the front line to find a sergeant, and this does happen, bawling out a lieutenant. The lieutenant was a tank commander. I asked the sergeant, what was wrong, because here we'd been waiting for tanks, we finally had them, and here was an infantry sergeant furious at a lieutenant who was in the tank. And I can't quote that sergeant exactly. But I'll give you my own version of what he said. And his remarks went about like this. "That so-and-so of a tank commander is backing off and leaving us here." "The tank commander," the sergeant said, "claims that the tank armor isn't up to the red tank." And the sergeant added, "And I've just been asking this so-and-so of a tank commander what kind of armor he thinks I've got on my back." Well, that sergeant was killed later that day. And I thought afterwards that if we'd had any kind of good anti-tank weapon, that his life might have not been wasted. People in wars have to get killed, sure, we're all agreed. But the number of people who will get killed, the proportion, the price you have to pay in human life, diminishes as your equipment and your training improves. If we'd had good equipment, we'd had well-trained people, we would have lost far fewer men in those early days. That's another example of how we were unprepared. I'm making these points in part because today, coming home from Korea, I read in the newspapers that some Americans, out of what they apparently think is kindness or softness or gentleness, are objecting to the draft of 18-year-olds. I don't know how many 18-year-olds there are in this audience. I do know this, that in our world, in our society as it's now constituted and in the balance of power in the world as it is now framed, I think it very likely that we'll have a world war. I don't say that we're going to for sure, but I think that there's a good possibility. I think that every American who is very young has a better chance of surviving that war if he's well trained. The better trained ones have ever so much better chance than the untrained ones. Let me tell you another incident, just to show you what I mean. Colonel Stevens, Colonel Richard Stevens of the 21st Infantry Regiment, and a lot of officers in those early days in Korea, had to stay up at company level with their men frequently to keep them fighting. It's as blunt as that. Many of our soldiers were green, soft, and turned and ran. It's perfectly understandable that someone will turn and run, especially when they think that a cause is hopeless. But as Colonel Stevens pointed out, the one person who panics, who gives away his position, endangers the lives of 20 people or 50 people, and maybe he'll get that entire company killed through his own panic. That's why it's good to have trained, tough Americans in a tough world. I've been telling you all about the grim side of the war in Korea. I'd like to tell you about some of the days of victory. And to me, one of the real accomplishments of our society and our time, and a proof of our technological skill and coordination at its best, was the Incheon landing. And I can't talk about the Incheon landing with all due credit to Mr. Truman's blast at the Marines without talking about the United States Marines. As a matter of fact, I think I'll start the whole thing by telling you of the only time that I was really, really mad at a United States Marine. This was after the Incheon landing when we were going into Seoul, and the incident took place on the Mapo Boulevard. The fight for Seoul was a very bloody one. A long, long time ago, I made a statement, which was a pretty rash one. I said that I walked out of Seoul, and I was going to walk back in. Well, many was the time that I didn't think I'd ever get back into Seoul, except perhaps as a prisoner of war. This was one of the rough days on Seoul's outskirts. We were behind one of those sand barricades, and the enemy opened up with anti-tank, machine gun, and small arms fire on our position, which was in the street. And bullets were kicking up all around us, and the correspondents, there were three of us, we took shelter in a small ditch along the side of the road. The Marines were crouched on by fences near us, and just to give you an idea of the setup, let me say parenthetically that the Marines seemed to think that correspondents had a key into American news, because no matter how isolated we were, they thought we knew everything that had gone on in the United States the day before. So a Marine saw us in the ditch, and he recognized us as correspondents. And he started, in the midst of all this fracas and hubbub, and there was an awful lot going on, started crawling over towards our ditch, which infuriated us because movement attracts fire. And so the closer he came, the closer the bullets came to us. I'd like to give you a blow-by-blow count. Won't be very long, but a timed count. H hour was 5:30. It was timed a half an hour before high tide, which was at 6 o'clock. At Incheon, the tides vary 30 feet in a period of 6 hours. The place where we landed at 5:30 and where it could have high tide at 6 was to have mud flats at 8. So it had to be a matter of complete precision. I went in with the fifth wave in the small rectangular assault boat, and my landing was at H hour plus 15 minutes.